I'm Bethany.
And I'm Joel.
And this is Sunday School Cinema, talking not about what we said we were going to talk about.
Yeah, change of plans. Turned out that the Frisbee movie was not as available as we thought it was, so we've had to delay that for the time being. And we're talking about another one of the weird, obscure religious documentaries that we have left. It's called What Would Jesus Buy? That probably none of you have ever heard of, because why would you have? It only has like a few hundred views on Letterboxd. It's quite obscure. I'm not really sure what it was produced for or who the like if it was made if it was. I noticed it had what's his name, the that irritating documentary guy as a producer. He was like, it was, he presented it. What's his name?
Morgan Spurlock.
Yeah, Morgan Spurlock. Yeah, it was like presented by him. So I don't know if it was a thing that was made for his, because he had like his own TV thing for a while, I think. I don't know. At any rate, it's a weird, obscure documentary of sorts.
It's up on YouTube. I don't even know if you can quite call it a religious documentary, and hopefully you cannot hear my dog being insane in the background. I'm hoping he'll chill out here in a second. But I don't know. I don't even know if you can call it a religious documentary, because I'm not actually sure. Like, the guy who is playing the preacher of the Church of No Shopping, like, this is like a performance art bit that he is doing. And I am not actually totally clear on how much of this is intended to he's like doing a thing of the idea of like preachers. But like, it's more about like consumerism and like capitalism, kind of. It's not even anti-capitalism. It's more about just like consumerism as like a general.
Yeah, I think it's pretty. I think it's pretty clear he's not religious in any specific way. Even in character, when he does prayers, he addresses them to I think the great mystery or something like that. Like he doesn't address them to God. But it is so. This is I guess we should say first off. Apparently, neither of us remembered anything about this movie. I know we watched it. I remembered the title. I thought that I had an idea in my head of what it was, but as it turned out, I did not remember any of it. Like, there was not a single familiar bit from it. I didn't remember the character of Reverend Billy. Nothing. But apparently, like, Reverend Billy and the Church of Stop Shopping, they have their own Wikipedia page. Like, they were, like, a known thing, at least in some places. They did this sort of nationwide anti-consumerism crusade where they would go around and stage protests at he's been arrested a few times for staging protests at like the Disney store in Times Square, and he was protests at like Starbucks. He had like a few big corporate sort of targets. Disney and Starbucks and Walmart and Target seem to be the main ones, at least in the documentary. Which, you know, that's fair. But he'll go with this, like, this sort of quote-unquote church group. They sort of style themselves as a church group, and he goes as this character of Reverend Billy, who is this very, like, over-the-top sort of televangelist-style preacher with, like, crazy blonde hair. He kind of reminded me of, what's his name, the guy from the Herzog movies.
Oh, yeah! I can't remember his name.
He had kind of a similar look to him, almost, like a... This sounds meaner than I intend it to, but he had kind of I feel like they're sort of like distinctively ugly guys in similar ways. Like, I really don't mean that to be unkind, but I think it's fair. What is that guy's name? It's really going to bother me.
I'm trying to find it.
Anyway, so he has this group with him that is the Stop Shopping Choir. And they do like gospel choir performances of like hymns and Christmas songs that they have redone to be about the evils of consumerism. it's all like, you know, it's this very like I guess like guerrilla theater kind of like protest. It's strange. It's not really a thing that it kind of reminded me of like that Improv Everywhere thing that used to pop up as viral videos online all the time for a while. It's kind of that type of thing, except it's much more political, explicitly political. And all sort of centered around this one character of Reverend Billy.
Klaus Kinski is who you were trying to think of.
That's the one. I really should have known that off the top of my head because I just recently finished listening to Herzog's memoir, an audiobook of it, which is great, incidentally. Side note, check that out if you get a chance. It's lovely.
Yeah. Klaus Kinski is who you're trying to think of, as I said. And also, I agree with you. That had not occurred to me at all. I did think he looked kind of familiar, but I don't think I've seen him before. So I think I was probably recognizing the same thing.
Yeah, that I had kind of the same thing while I was watching it. And that comparison didn't really click with me until this morning. I watched it last night. But yeah, it's a lot of it's the hair. Like he has like very, very thick blonde, like very blonde hair. I assume bleached. Like it didn't look like it could possibly be his natural hair color. but anyway, so it's not a good documentary. Like it's a mess, frankly. Like it's chaotic. It doesn't really seem to have any real direction. It just kind of follows these guys around and shows bits and pieces of their stuff. Like there's really no like central theme or thesis to it, it seems.
They're also not like, okay, they're talking about the evils of all of these corporations, and like, look, you do not have to convince me that Walmart is evil, but I will say this is 2007, and like, you know, I feel like some of these conversations have become broader in the ever like ever more rapidly disintegration of capitalism. There's what I'm looking for. Anyway, but like, yeah, you don't have to convince me that Disney is fucking evil, but like, they also never really offer any alternatives, which is like the thing is that if you are making people aware, if the goal is to make people aware of the horrors of the world, if you do that and then are like, figure it out, like most people are not going to do that.
Right. I mean, the closest thing to an alternative they present, at least in the documentary, is shop local, right? Which, but it, I kept thinking while watching this, like, it seemed weirdly quaint. I feel like during this time period, the issues of consumerism, particularly around the holidays, was a thing that people talked about a lot, including in churches. It was like a big thing that people talked about. And it just doesn't seem to be an issue that people talk about anymore, because I don't think it's accurate to say we have bigger issues now, but like the issues have shifted, and I don't remember the last time I heard someone go on a rant about the evils of consumerism, but it was like a big issue for a while. It's just kind of a strange, like it's very of the time, I guess. And maybe it felt much more, maybe it had a lot more punch to it at the time. I don't know. There's a fair amount of time spent on like, you know, that like with Walmart in particular, the, you know, like sweatshop labor, and there's some interview clips with people who were, you know, like, human rights attorney type people who work with sweatshop laborers overseas, and, you know, talking about the horrible conditions that they work under and all this stuff. And so part of the thing is that he's trying to like bring that to people's attention, and like, it's all kind of mildly interesting and probably worthwhile, but I don't know, it's weird. I found him and the whole thing to be very interesting, but the documentary itself is not like, it's kind of a nothing. Like there's it just looks like someone filmed an hour and a half. Well, it looks like someone followed them around for a couple months with a camera and filmed everything, and then someone took an hour and a half of footage almost at random and put it together.
No, there's no through line, there's no story, there's no anything, and I just, like, and I don't care, I find him obnoxious, I find, half the time it felt like he was trying to do, like, a parody type of thing, but honestly, it's hard to parody that type of person, like, it doesn't feel like parody, it just feels like, and, like, I just don't care.
And we have some almost like Sacha Baron Cohen style things where, at least from what it looks like in the documentary, he has gotten on to like local morning shows and stuff like that with people who are not aware that this is like a performance bit, who think that he's like an actual preacher. And so, you know, there's a lot of stuff like that. I think I found him less annoying than you. I wouldn't say that I found him like compelling or like I would want to join up with his movement or whatever, but I did find him kind of entertaining. but which is probably the gap between our ratings of this movie, although I may have you know, I watched this movie late at night and was kind of half focusing on it because it didn't really hold my attention that well. So I may have given it a little too much benefit of the doubt. I would say that's also entirely possible.
It was just bad. Like, I don't, and I was trying to think of, like, I was like, okay, like, I don't remember a lot of the most of the movies that we watched for group one or both of us had seen beforehand. It wasn't true with 100% of the movies, and it's possible that I just saw the title of this and was like, but like, it's also possible that I've actually seen this twice and I don't remember it at all.
Well, most of them we tried to watch them just us, like, the day before, so that we could kind of get an idea of talking points and stuff. We definitely didn't manage that every time, but we tried to do that. But I don't remember if there was anything that we watched and neither of us had seen it at all. But I guess it's possible there were a few.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I was trying to think what would have appealed to me particularly about this movie. And I do think that it is possible. I mean, 2007, so that's, what, 17 years ago. I mean, we didn't watch it then. So it's probably like, you know, 15 years ago or something, or 12 that we watched it. But like, my thoughts and feelings around capitalism and all of those kinds of things have changed a lot. I think that a thing we have touched on at different points in this podcast is that, like, it's hard to overstate how obsessed with capitalism evangelicals are, and how much of white evangelicalism is just a capitalist grift. And it's, and, like, you know, like, again, that there were, that so much money was being made in these circles, and especially around, like, especially in, like, the 90s and 80s and that sort of, where they have, you know, like, alternate Christian bands for every secular band, and there's an incredible amount of money going into this, into the quote unquote artists, most of whom I don't think are that artisty, but some of them, and such, and it's such, like, it's part of being, like, a good American, and, like, and that's a big part of white evangelicalism. And I think that Dad probably would have agreed with the buy local. He had sort of a vague concept of, like, you know, you shouldn't, like, made in America sort of thing is, like, a good thing. I don't feel like either of our parents ever, like, meaningfully pursued that or actually
cared. I don't believe either of our parents have ever decided not to buy something because it was made overseas. I don't think that was ever, yeah, they may have, I'm sure they both would pay lip service to the idea, yeah, you should buy American or whatever, but yeah, they're not that committed to it.
They're not that committed to fucking anything. Anyway, but like, but so I can see having watched this when I was younger and being like, this is not something that I like it feeling weird or interesting because I really had never heard anyone like decry. I was going to say decry capitalism, but again, this isn't even really that. And like, churches decry consumerism all the time while making an incredible amount of money. But like, I think that some of these like specific attacks on corporations that were like not about, you know, there were people who boycotted Disney when we were kids, but it was because they supported gays or something, a thing which
that was a big focus of it, yeah, which is kind of ironic, really. Now it's the gay people boycotting Disney because they're not gay enough.
so true. Okay, anyway, so I can see myself having been interested in sort of what this is like tiptoeing around, but like, it's just nothing.
I agree with you that there's the documentary is very, it is not substantive or well made. Like, there just really isn't. It maybe should have been 20 minutes long, and you know, that it could have been interesting. But I don't know. I find the character and the performance and the sort of protest concept, I think I'm more interested in it than you are, maybe. I don't know. I would not venture to make any kind of statement as to how effective it is, whether it's accomplishing much or not. There's some kind of interesting bits in this where, you know, they go out and do like man on the street type interviews asking people about, like, you know, do you know where your clothes come from? Do you know about these sweatshop conditions, all this? And there's, you know, people just have no idea, and, you know, and people are kind of outraged when they find out in a lot of cases. But, you know, again, you know, I don't know, does that actually change anyone's behavior? Is that, you know, and as with all man on the street things, you know, that the 95% of the people that they held a mic up to, I don't care, just walked away. I think that's always how those things go. And then they just show the interesting ones. So,
yeah. And I mean, I think that, I mean, in one case, there was like one of the Man on the Street interviews where the woman was like, look, yeah, they send stuff overseas to get made so they can be cheaper, and then they make it cheaper here. But like, what are we going to do? Like, this is just what's happening. But they don't have an answer to that question, really. And I think that, again, like someone is, they had one talking head for like half a second that was like, you need to like offer people, you have to like engage with what shopping is actually doing for people, and had like a card for people to like, you know, do I need this? Where am I going to put it? What, you know, like that, can I pay? How am I paying for it? That sort of thing. Which is like at least potentially a practical thing. But like, they don't really have any interest in practical things as far as I can tell. And I have a lot of disdain, I think, for movements that are like trying to raise a conversation that they have no functional answer for, because I think that's actually more harmful in the long run.
Yeah, I think so. It's from what I could tell, the origin of this was his protests at Disney, the Disney store in Times Square, and the way that this sort of consumerism and like tourist shopping was kind of like ruining this part of his city, because he's a New Yorker. I think that was kind of the genesis of the thing. And a lot of the focus in the documentary is clearly on like either on very wealthy people who were just there was the bit with the couple who went to this. I got a good laugh out of that. There's this couple. There's this bit where this young couple goes to this store, and we see them going up to the counter and saying like, you know, we moved and our poor little girl, like her whole Christmas wardrobe, the whole box is just gone. We can't find it. It's all gone. So we got to replace everything. And then we see them go through and buy like, is it like a Gucci handbag and like just crazy expensive stuff for what it seems to be like a toddler or something like that. And then we see them in their giant house, and she shows them to this huge walk-in closet where the kid's wardrobe is, and it's rows and rows of fancy clothes and all this. And then we get the reveal that it's not even a kid, it's a chihuahua. I got a really good laugh out of that. That was very funny.
I just like...
So a lot of the focus of the documentary is on that kind of, like, it's this sort of obviously extravagant spending. There's not a lot of focus on people who shop at Walmart because otherwise their kids won't have shoes, right? That is not his focus. And I agree that's probably it's a more complicated but probably more worthwhile center of focus for attention.
Well, it's also, okay, one, like, yeah, you're not going to, like, impress the top 5%, or they're not going to give a shit. Two, like, yes, there's a lot of like weird poverty fetishization in this movie as well, of like the number of people being like, we didn't have anything but apples and oranges for Christmas and we were so happy. And like, I just like, I don't, you are not actually engaging with any of the actual systems that are in place that are making this happen. You are not actually talking about like what to do instead of this, how to. And again, I think part of the problem is that this actually is not critiquing capitalism that hard. It is critiquing consumerism. And those are two different things that are closely connected. But like, without critiquing capitalism, it feels fucking absurd.
I agree. I guess I'm curious what your read, like, do you think the Reverend Billy is sincere? Like, do you think that this is, he sees this as an actual issue that needs to be solved, or do you think it's just a performance bit? I guess
I hope it's a performance bit, because if it's sincere, I think he's doing way more harm than good. And so, like, I genuinely believe that. I really believe that if you bring up, like, if you bring up, so, like, all of my time teaching and training and all of these things, this comes up every single time. If you bring up really difficult, challenging things, especially difficult, challenging things that are requesting that people figure out how to live their lives differently, that are saying the way you are living your life is bad and is harming people, if you approach that and you do not bring them concrete ways, help them think through how to do that, you are doing harm. Because what they will do, and it is a natural human thing to do, is that they will be like, oh my God, this is like so much, I feel guilty, I feel shame, I feel overwhelmed by this, but there is nothing I can do about it. And so I just need to like stop thinking about it. And so what happens is that you actually build like a wall to some extent, where when they hear that, oh no, I don't want to hear about that because I can't do anything about it. Like, I actually think it causes serious harm to not have some sort of answer for what you are presenting. And so I hope that he's just doing it as a, like, I'm sure to some extent he believed, like you said, this was like a big thing at the time where we were talking about this constantly. It was a little quaint watching all the videos of like people like stumbling over them each other in Walmart, because I was like, that just doesn't happen. At
the the whole thing with like the, you know, people getting crushed in the Black Friday rush in the, you know, the doors at Target, all that was like a weird sort of moment in time that we seem to be past now, fortunately, because it was like a particularly gross cultural thing. But it got bad enough that we seem to be, at least for the moment, it seems to have gone away.
Now we just spend all the money on Amazon, which has...
Well, right. That's true. We don't have to camp out outside the stores anymore. That's a big part of what... that's true. I guess all the stores are like, oh, we're not doing Black Friday sales anymore. And it's like, yeah, because you start Black Friday sales on Monday now. They just go all week.
Well, it's actually a weird... A thing I was thinking about regarding that is it's a weird thing. Like, look, obviously all of like these... just very, very intense Black Friday stuff was ultimately probably a harmful thing for society. I only went Black Friday shopping once, and not out of any like moral whatever, it just sounded terrible to me. And but Mona wanted to go, and I wanted a new feather comforter, I think, at the time, and it was on sale at JCPenney or something. So we went one time, and the thing is that if you're talking about like community, there's actually a lot more like communal in-person experience, and like because the vast majority of them were not trampling each other in Walmart. The vast majority of them are like in a crowd way, and it's a little chaotic, sure, but then you're in line for like a fucking hour with people and talking to people, and like, and it was actually like I did not enjoy it, to be clear. I was very tired. It was like 3 o'clock in the morning, and I was exhausted, and our parents had been over to Mona's for Thanksgiving that year, and like I was just worn out. But like, but there was like a sense of like being with other people in a way that ironically we sort of don't have now for the shopping. And I'm not saying we should go back to that kind of, God knows, I'm not saying that we should go back to that kind of like Black Friday shopping. I'm just saying like it's a deeply complicated and also like there are, sure, a lot of people are going and buying Black Friday stuff because like, you know, they wanted more stuff or whatever, but like also it was way cheaper in some places, and they did want, like, it's just like it's just impossible to engage with consumerism without meaningfully engaging with what capitalism has done and is like taking from us. And it feels irresponsible to me from this vantage point to look at it and be like, really, this is all you're gonna do is be like Walmart and Disney are the fucking devil? Also, how did you not get sued for using Disney font? Because I have serious questions.
I wondered about that too. I think it must have been like a minor variation, because the whole opening credits are in like Disney font, and I had the exact same thought. I was like, really, can you just use that? Because surely you'd see it all over the place if you could just use that, right?
Well, and it was, and like the cards for like the talking heads and stuff, all of it was in like this Disney-esque font. And you're probably right, it's probably a minor variation apart from it, and since, you know, 150 people ever watched this movie, I guess it didn't. But usually Disney is very litigious.
Well, yeah, and they clearly like have their eye on this guy, so you, because we see in the documentary, we see him get arrested during the, I think, what was the first protest he did at a Disney store in Times Square. And then sort of the, I guess the climax of the movie is that he and his group go and sort of sneak into Disneyland and stage a performance, a protest, you know, on the streets in Disneyland. But it's, again, I say that's kind of the climax of it, but the documentary is pretty structureless. Like, it could have been structured to build up to like a climax of that, but it really, like, it just, it's not the climax. It just happens to occur towards the end.
Well, and also no one at Disney cares. Like, they have just... Also, you purchased a whole bunch of overpriced tickets to get into Disney to stay. You did not sneak in. You walked to the front door with a shit ton of tickets.
They didn't sneak in. They just didn't... They snuck their costumes and stuff in, I guess, is what I meant to say. Yeah, they didn't go in as a choir because... Yeah, anyway.
No, for sure. But, like, I'm just saying, you spent hundreds of dollars... You gave Disney hundreds of dollars to come in here, yell and sing for a moment while all of these families, like, stared at you and were like, what the fuck are you doing? And then the, you know, poor Disney employee who's making not nearly enough per hour had to be like, for the love of God, would you please leave and call security? Like, I just don't, like... I don't know. I don't want to say that, like, no performance art is useful or that no... Because I don't think that's true. I think there are ways to do that. And I am not a performance artist, so I'm sure that there are people who are far more qualified to talk about this than me. But I just, like, we never... It feels like a show that they're put... Like, to me, it feels like Reverend Billy is excited to be a part of the show and is excited to like be running this thing and is excited like that it is at least as much about Reverend Billy as it is about consumerism.
Yeah, see, I think in a better made documentary we would get a lot more insight into Reverend Billy, I think, because we really don't get much. Like, most of what we see is him in character. We see him out of character sometimes, and like his wife is the director of the show, and so she's there all the time, and we see some interactions between the two of them, but we never get like, there's never any like direct to camera, like him talking about his motivations or like, you know, I would have been curious to see more of that. Cause it, I don't know. I think a lot of what you're talking about your problems with it, with what he's doing, or at least what he's, again, I'm not convinced we're getting anything like the full picture of of what he's doing from this documentary, but I think it tends to be a problem with protest movements as in general. You know,
I would agree.
It is meant to be an attention grabbing thing. It's not meant to be like a, you know, here's your whole like holistic, this is the problem, here's a series of solutions, here's how you can implement them. Like, that's not what protest movements are about, right?
No, and I think that there are, like, I think part of it is it's just him and these, like, 20 people, and we never get any sense that, like, anyone else is, like, particularly invested or involved in this. Like, look, I mean, obviously, lately, we've seen, obviously, in the last 10 years, we've seen a tremendous number of protest movements that I think, you know, the protest movements are ultimately, like, designed to disrupt and, like, make people stop and think about things. We've seen a lot with Gaza and all that kind of stuff. I guess I just feel like, particularly in 2007, like, there's a part of me that feels like, okay, like, if I see a protest movement or something now, I do have the ability to pretty easily look up and figure out more information about that. And it just, like, I don't know, maybe I'm just like showing my age. Okay, point one, it wouldn't matter if I thought it was a super effective protest. This is a fucking terrible documentary, and I felt angry that I had to watch it. So, like, there's that. It honestly wouldn't matter to me if it was, maybe it would be worse if I thought it was an effective protest movement, because then you just made a really bad documentary about an effective protest movement. But, like, I guess it just felt, watching it, it just felt sort of like self-absorbed and smug to me, and it didn't feel like yes, you're just, and like, it's kind of funny to watch you like exercising the Walmart sign, but like, I don't, like, it just feels like nothing to me, and I'm mad I had to watch it for 90 minutes.
Yeah, that's fair. I did a little reading, you know, like I said, there's like a Wikipedia page about them and stuff, and they're, I don't know if they're still active, but they continued to be active at least for several years after this, and they kind of expanded their focus a bit. Apparently they did protests around Monsanto and you know, chemical pollution and stuff, which is obviously quite outside the scope of what they were doing in this, which I, you know, that's kind of interesting too. I would have been curious to see like how, if they saw those things as related, or if they were just like, we're not getting the attention that we used to get from this consumerism thing and we need to shift our focus. I don't know what the case is there, but it's interesting. And you know, Monsanto, I'm okay with people do whatever the fuck you want to protest Monsanto.
No, for sure. I just, like, I don't know. I think mostly I was just wildly bored. And I just, like, I couldn't get over how fucking incompetently made this documentary was. And, like, I just, I don't know. Maybe it's a timing issue, too. Maybe it felt different in 2007, 2008, or whenever we watched it. Watching it now, it just felt like the biggest muddled mess. And it almost, in some ways, was worse. Though, like, I agreed with some of what they're saying. And some of what they're saying, I think, has become much, much more mainstream topics of discussion as fast fashion and stuff has become sort of, like, the overwhelming thing. But, like, this is such an incompetent packaging that, like, even if you're trying to say something, it just feels ridiculous to even, like, meaningfully engage with it because it's so bad.
I mean, yeah, it felt like something that I could have made, which is not something that I possibly have ever thought about a movie that I watched. Like, it just, yeah, it didn't really seem like there was any filmmaking behind it, I guess. The director is a guy named Rob Van, what is it? Van Alkemade? I don't know. Van Alkemade? I don't know where the emphasis goes on that, but he has not done anything else that you would have heard of, and I don't know. I don't have any idea what his credentials or overall skill level are like, I guess. But there is no real sign of a a guiding creative force happening behind this movie.
Yeah, it's I don't know. I don't really have anything else to say about it. I just found it annoying, and I was also sad that we weren't watching the Frisbee movie, which I feel like would have had more interesting things to talk about, but that will come later. So, well.
So, this is not actually related to this movie. It was just a thing that I discovered because of this movie that I was going to mention to you, and since I think we're done talking about the movie. So, you know, on Letterboxd, if you're on the Letterboxd page for it, and you scroll down to like where the cast and crew is, there's also these other categories. You can see details, and it'll show you like the production companies that worked on it and stuff. And I was just kind of curious, like, I'd never heard of any of them. I was like, have they made other movies, whatever? So I clicked on the first one, which is called Palisades Pictures. And they have 7 different credits here, and they're none of them were things I'd heard of. But one of them had a familiar face on the cover, so I clicked on it. It's a documentary called Last Party 2000. It's from 2001. And it is a documentary about the 2000 presidential election, the run-up to the presidential election, looking at like the primaries of both parties and stuff, that features and I guess is sort of hosted by Philip Seymour Hoffman. I don't know if this is available anywhere, if you can find it, if you can watch it. But it's filmed over the last 6 months of the 2000 presidential election. Philip Seymour Hoffman starts documenting the campaign at the Republican and Democratic National Conventions. And the description is not very well written. It kind of goes on for a while, but fascinating. I kind of want to watch that now, just because it's, you know, obviously we love Philip Seymour Hoffman here, one of the all time greats, RIP. It only has 236 people have watched it on, have logged it on Letterboxd. So I don't know if it ever got any kind of release. What the deal is, but anyway, completely irrelevant to this movie. It's just it happened to be produced by the same production company or distribution company, maybe, I don't know, but it caught my eye, and it sounds fascinating, so I figured I'd mention it.
Huh, yeah, I mean, I would also watch that, so interesting. Okay, I don't think we have anything else to say about the movie. I don't think either of us would necessarily recommend watching it.
God, no. There's no reason to watch it. I mean, unless you're, like, really specifically interested in the idea of, like, performance as protest or something like that. But I'm sure there are you could find much better examples on YouTube without too much trouble, I'll bet.
This is on YouTube, but yeah, it's bad. Anyway, so, yeah. So, what are we going to watch next time? We have 21 movies left. So,
okay, what's number 12?
Number 12 is In Good Company.
Oh, well, yeah. So I think this was one that we kind of watched as throwing a bone to Dad, because this is one of his favorite movies. I don't know what I'm going to think of this movie now. I feel like I'm going to have probably not a lot of great feelings about it now, but I don't know. We'll see.
It's an interesting movie to follow up a conversation around capitalism on. The only thing I remember that there's sort of like a mentory relationship, and mostly I just remember that for years afterwards we would just say synergy. Topher Grace.
I mean, it has a great cast for Dennis Quaid and Topher Grace and Scarlett Johansson and Malcolm McDowell is in it. Like it's a really good cast. So at least it'll probably be in. I mean, it's, you know, Scarlett Johansson, before she was a big deal, she was like 5th on the cast list or something like that. So it should be interesting on that level, at least. I think it was the same guys who made About a Boy, which is a movie that I rewatched a year or so ago and did really love still. So maybe.
Our father doesn't traditionally have the best taste in films, but I did also like this when I was young. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, Dad likes a lot of great movies, but it's more by coincidence, because he doesn't like them because of the things that make them good. There just happen to be a lot of good movies that share traits that Dad looks for. So
that's accurate. That's accurate. Okay, cool. I'm not like angry that we're watching it. There are some on here that I am still not thrilled about, but like, yeah. All right. Well, we'll do that. Okay, I'm guessing this will be a somewhat shorter episode than usual, because our recording schedule is slightly off, so this is only a week since we recorded the last one, so neither of us will have watched that much.
Yeah, I've only got about half a dozen things to talk about here.
same. And so yeah, we'll have a little short one, and then the next one will probably be longer because God knows we never have any consistency with how long or short our episodes are, and it's fine. I think you went first last time, so I guess I can go first. So after we recorded last time, Morgan and I watched our Criterion movie of the week from our 52 Criterion. We've been doing really good this year. We are on top of it. We've been watching one every Sunday.
This is something that I should have asked a long time ago because you've been talking about this for ages, but I'm not totally clear. They're not all movies that Criterion have released, right? Is it just all stuff that's on the Criterion channel? Is that what it is? I know it's a thing that a lot of people do, but I haven't actually looked into it in detail.
So I don't think Criterion has anything to do with the actual list. This is like something that someone on Letterboxd like put together, and they put a new one together every year. So like the list is like, so it's like 52, so it's supposed to be one for each week, and it includes like a movie from this collection. A lot of times there's usually like a handful of like a movie from so-and-so's favorite movies best movies, because they like, for directors and actors and stuff, they often have them choose. And so then there's like a listing of those. A lot of them are Criterion movies, but some of them are just like are this collection that the Criterion channel ran or whatever. So the vast majority of them we watch on Criterion. Some of them are off of Criterion channel by the time we watch them, and we watch them somewhere else. We pick at the beginning of the year. We go through the whole list. We do, I think this year Morgan had odds and I had evens, and go through. And then make the list in advance so that we can just easily go through it. The last one is like something off your watch list. So I'm doing that one this year, and I usually just hold off on that until the end of the year. Well, I mean, we didn't finish last year, but the year before.
Okay. Yeah, I really should have clarified that ages ago, because you've been bringing this up basically every week for ages. But yeah,
this is definitely the best we've done. The first year we did it, we ended up with like 25 Criterion movies to watch at the end of the year, which is like a big ask at the end of the year or any other time. And last year we were going to end up with like 25, and I was just like, I am not up for this. So I think I gave up, which was a big moment, a big step for me, not something I can usually do. But this year we're really, really doing well. And also I think we really focused this year, at least I did for sure, on picking movies that I was more excited to see and less that I felt like I had to watch.
That helps a lot. Yeah.
That has helped. So last week we watched A Matter of Life and Death, the Powell Pressburger movie. Have you seen that?
I have not.
Cool. You like Powell Pressburger, right? Or like, I remember you didn't like Black Narcissus as much as me. I loved Black Narcissus, but you liked Red Shoes.
Black Narcissus was definitely in the category of movies that I didn't get. And like, I very much intend to go back to it someday, and I expect that I will eventually love it. I just talked about this in the last episode. This is a thing for me. I did like The Red Shoes. I remember enjoying that one. I think those might be the only two of theirs that I've seen.
Yeah, I have seen several of their movies. I mean, obviously they're gorgeous. They're always like absolutely beautiful to watch. I have seen these three that I have just mentioned, and then also I Know Where I'm Going, which was a movie with, I guess I don't recognize anyone in it. I don't actually remember the movie, but I gave it 3 stars. I don't know. Anyway, so you know, this is a weird, like way weirder than I expected it to be. It's like a romance. Like the movie starts with the opening scene of the movie is David Niven. It's very funny to me to have David Niven as a romantic lead, because to me he is just the dad in Mary Poppins, and that is just always the case.
I saw him in quite a few things, mostly when I was younger. I haven't seen anything recently, but I don't know that I've ever seen him as a romantic lead. That does seem a little weird.
So he's a fighter pilot in like World War II, and like he's going down, like he's gonna like, and his crewmate is already dead, and he's radioing, and he talks to this woman on the radio, and then tells her he doesn't have a parachute. He's gonna jump. The parachute that they had got shredded, and he's just gonna jump, and he would rather jump and, you know, hit than like get burned up in the crash or whatever. So he jumps. But he doesn't die. And the other half of the movie takes place in heaven, where...
Hey, I have heard of this. I thought the thing with the crashing pilot sounded familiar. I wonder if Film Spotting did an episode about this or something. I feel like I've heard someone talk about this movie in detail.
That would make sense. So the other half takes place in heaven, where they're like waiting for him to arrive. But the person, the being who was supposed to, missed him because of the terrible London fogs, like missed him in the thing.
So that he didn't die because he didn't get snatched up by the Grim Reaper person? Okay.
It's actually a French diplomat person who's dead and whose job is now to do this. But anyway, and so they are trying to get him to come back because their books are off. And he, meanwhile, has somehow landed and is fine and goes to, like, finds the woman that he was talking to and is in love with her and is going to marry her and, of course, doesn't want to die now and go to heaven and is having these. An interesting thing about the movie is that it is unclear whether or not this is actually happening. You can take this as you will. This woman has a friend who is a doctor, who is like a brain specialist, and like they're doing like surgery on him at some point because he has like something pressing on his brain. So it could be that this is all hallucinatory.
So at least on the surface, this all sounds like a very like wacky comic concept, which is not what I think of with them from the two that I have seen. Is it a comedy?
I think it is kind of a comedy. It's really cool. Like, it's really cool looking. All of the like, have they built like these, they built like this insane giant escalator with like giant statues that they have a bunch of scenes on. They had like the all of the work around the look of it is incredible. The first scene in heaven where like these pilots are like filing in the door and are like signing their names, and then they get handed like a dry cleaning bag but with wings. it's really fun, and it looks, of course, absolutely gorgeous. Every time the French angel person shows up to talk to him, like everything else freezes, and they use sound in this, like, where at one point I was like, because no one else can see him, and at one point I thought the movie had actually like frozen, like there's no sound and there's no, and it was just like paused on this.
I'm just wondering, the look on my face was because I was like, how did they even achieve that effect back then? Like, that's a thing I've seen a lot now, but I don't know how they would have done that back then.
It's pretty cool. And like, of course, the color and everything is gorgeous. Heaven is black and white and Earth is in color. Anyway, so there is actually a line where the Frenchman looks at the camera and is like, we're starved for Technicolor up there. It was really fun. It was, I don't know what I was expecting exactly, but it was like way more fun than whatever I was expecting. And it's just very cool. Like, it's very cool to look at. So super recommend that. That one is up on Criterion. And then we were pretty high and I was like, okay, let's watch something that I want to get over with. Because I'm very high right now. Maybe it won't be as bad. It didn't help. But so we watched The Love Guru, which I...
So was I literally can't remember. Was that Adam Sandler or was it Mike Myers?
Mike Myers.
Okay. It sounds so much like an Adam Sandler premise, but I was pretty sure it was Mike Myers. Okay. Continue.
So I went into this is definitely one of those movies that I'm holding blank check to account for. They apparently they watched all the Austin Powers movies, and apparently at some point they were drunk and they were like, wouldn't it be funny if we watched The Love Guru 2? And they regretted that decision, but not enough. I don't think they regretted it enough. I think they should be forced to watch it 72,000 more times. I went into this expecting it to be terrible, of course. Like, I remember when it came out and at the time being like, what the actual fuck? It was worse. It was worse than I thought it would be, which is really quite impressive in a number of ways. One, this is a character that Myers apparently came up with in the 90s, which makes sense. And like, just didn't get made until 2008, I think, is when it came out. Yeah, 2008.
It's such a 90s premise. Like, it's insane that he still had the clout to get this movie made in 2008. Like, I know the Austin Powers movies were huge, but like, come on.
And Shrek. But yeah,
that's probably what it was, I guess, huh? Yeah.
It's so bad. It's so incomprehensibly bad. It's literally the entire movie, which is only 85 minutes, but feels so much longer, is Mike Myers making mostly dick jokes. And call them jokes is like way too strong. Like, it's mostly that he just thinks that like referring to anatomy is like a joke. And then quite literally turning to the camera to explain to you what the joke was. That is basically the entire movie. He also really likes, acronyms, or like, is it acronym? Yeah, where it's like a word, but then each letter stands for. Yeah. He really likes those. So he'll have like a PowerPoint up behind him periodically explaining what these things are. Also, he's a guru who wrote who writes books like Stop Hitting Yourself, Ow, Stop Hitting Yourself, Ow. There's about 20 of these. He just brings them up periodically throughout the course of the movie. The plot, such as it is that he's angry about constantly being the second place guru to Deepak Chopra, who does show up in the movie at some point. And so he's trying to... Oh, God. There's a hockey team where their best player is doing badly because he broke up with his wife. His wife is currently sleeping with Justin Timberlake, the character played by Justin Timberlake, who the entire joke around Justin Timberlake is that he is Canadian and has a bad Canadian accent, and that his dick is so big that when he takes down his pants, you can hear it hit the floor. That's it. That's the whole thing. Also, Mike Myers' character wears a chastity belt, so every time he gets an erection, there's a gong sound.
Is it meant to be an Indian person that he's playing, or is he supposed to be a Canadian who is just doing this as an affectation?
His parents were missionaries who were killed, and he ended up staying in India. So he grew up learning this from fucking Ben Kingsley, who plays a guru who is wildly cross-eyed. That's basically the entire joke about Ben Kingsley. It has a number, so many people who showed up in it for some reason, for at least small things. And every bit of it is the worst thing ever. It's super like homophobic in like a 90s way, but in like 2008, like there's so many jokes about like gay people and about it's so like Mike Myers should have been banished from all society for the rest of time. Like
the funny thing is that it's the concept of like a completely unfunny character who makes nothing but dick jokes and then will turn to the camera to explain the jokes. That sounds like it could kind of work as maybe like an SNL bit that's like 3 minutes long. Like I feel like you could get some laughs out of that. And like it seems like the kind of character that was conceived for that, not to be the center of a feature-length movie.
It was John Oliver's first role. And like, I'm not going to say he played a man named Dick Pants. His name was Richard Pants. And then Mike Myers turned to the camera and said, "You see, it's Dick Pants."
Wow. See, that's like anti-comedy. Like, that's not a joke. That feels like it seems like the concept there was, look how not funny this guy is. But from what you're telling me, it doesn't sound like that's the angle the movie takes.
I won't say that John Oliver is especially funny. I just have such a deep fondness for John Oliver that like every time I was hearing his voice instead of Mike Myers' voice, it was good. Let's not forget that every time Mike Myers tells a joke or explains a joke or whatever, he does his stupid like and it's terrible. It's terrible every time. So John Oliver is his like assistant Dick Pants who is helping him whatever. Stephen Colbert is in it as a hockey. Like there's a ton of people that like Myers has a lot of connections from everything. And there's a ton of people who just, but like, I was like, I remember finding the first Austin Powers movie sort of funny. I don't know. I haven't watched it in years, but Morgan watched it pretty recently and said there were a few laughs in there. And Shrek had some stuff in it. I mean, I don't think it holds up that well for me personally, but like, I was obsessed with So You Married an Axe Murderer.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. That is 90% of any fondness I have for Mike Myers is from So I Married an Axe Murderer, which is a movie that I still find very funny. I watched it a couple years ago, and it's still funny.
I keep meaning to rewatch it, but this has made me not want to do that. This has made me regret ever thinking that Mike Myers was funny for even a second. It's just so bad. That's probably more than enough talking about it. It's just so fucking bad. I just cannot. Anyway, and then a few days later, we watched the Pierce Brosnan Thomas Crown Affair. Have you seen the Pierce?
I have not. I've heard mostly good things about it, but I've never gotten around to it.
It was fine. Morgan liked it better than me. I don't find Pierce Brosnan charming. I don't find him charming. He just does nothing for me. He's mostly a blank slate. I find him like kind of okay as like his character in the Mamma Mia movies, but he's such a bad singer that it really like offsets that.
I don't know that I've really, other than Bond obviously and Mamma Mia, I can't really think of anything I've seen him in that might be all I've seen him in.
I do appreciate that he as a person has been married to the same woman for many years and she's now fat and he seems just as in love with her as he ever did, and people talk shit about him and his relationship with his fat wife and they look happy as hell, and I love that for them, and like that's fantastic. But like, and Rene Russo, I don't have any feelings about really. It's clearly supposed to be a very sexy movie. That's
mostly what I hear about it, I feel like, yeah.
I feel for myself that for something to be sexy, I have to at any point believe that any single person in this movie is a person. And that never happened to me. I felt like everyone, particularly Rene Russo in a lot of ways, but in general was a cartoon that was like a person shaped cartoon. It was very, and it was kind of funny for that. Like I kept being like, what are you wearing? What is happening? Like the first time they have sex. And like, where this is partly just that I'm old, to be clear. But like, the first time they have sex on the like marble floor of his palatial estate thing. Fine, sure, whatever. Seems sort of uncomfortable. Then it cuts to them having sex on marble stairs, to which I am like, oh God.
Ooh, that's bad.
And I'm like, sir, do you not have a bed? And then they are upstairs in the library and she is in a chair and they are having sex. And then he throws her on a desk. At no point do we have any confirmation that Pierce Brosnan in fact has a bed. which, I mean, to be clear, that mostly was just very funny to me. I was just like, I don't think at any age I would have wanted to have sex on marble stairs.
Yeah, no, that's just unacceptable. That's, yeah, no way.
Rene Russo is very pretty. We see a lot of her tits like that. There's just whole scenes where she's just topless. And there's a refreshing quality to that in this age of like no sex that we've talked about a lot. Like it was fine. I didn't have like a miserable time watching it, but I also like don't care. Faye Dunaway, who of course was in the original Thomas Crown Affair, and she's his psychiatrist in this one. And it's extremely funny that she basically just thinks he's an asshole and keeps being like, just keeps like literally just laughs at him periodically, which I think she's a terrible psychiatrist, but she's really funny to watch. It's fine. You might like it more than me. Morgan liked it more than me. I like heist movies, but I'm not obsessed with heist movies. And like Morgan likes heists more than me. So
yeah, it's interesting. I think it's one of those movies that a lot of people talk about as like a remake that's better than the original. I feel like
could be. I've seen
Steve McQueen and Faye Dunaway.
I've seen the original, but I have no memory of it whatsoever. I think I gave it roughly the same rating. So,
I did not realize. I was looking it up to see who directed it. I didn't realize that John McTiernan directed the Thomas Crown Affair, which I suppose is why you watched it, right? I didn't know that. The original was directed by Norman Jewison, who also did a lot of he did Moonstruck and In the Heat of the Night and some really great stuff. So I've never seen either one, so I can't really speak to their quality, but it is a thing that I've heard a lot that this is a like the rare example of a remake that tops the original, but I don't know.
Yeah, I mean it's fine. I'm not like necessarily bashing it. It's just it was a very silly movie to me. And then we are on a hiatus from The Bachelor for now until the new Bachelorette starts in like
what
summer.
A shame.
So we're watching Twilight, and which was not intentional, but Ezra did send me a thing this morning of someone being like, how to prepare for the eclipse by watching Twilight and New Moon, which was not on purpose. We will be watching New Moon this week and not the eclipse. But anyway, so we watched that. I don't have a lot to say about that, and you don't care. But I love Twilight.
I did have a... So there, I was at the Pickford a couple weeks ago to see something else, and they are going to be doing a showing, or maybe already have at this point, of Twilight, and so they showed the trailer for it. And it is one of those, this is neither here nor there, but it is one of those things that, like, it's always weird to watch old movie trailers, and, like, I don't know, maybe this is not a fair thing to say, but it seems like old movie trailers were just bad. Like, they just hadn't figured out the art of cutting a movie trailer until, like, relatively recently, like, until, like, the last 10 years. That trailer showed, like, half of the climactic fight sequence was in the trailer. Like, it just kept going back to shots. It was very strange and, like, just very poorly put together and very funny for that reason. And it's weird to think that looking at it through the eyes of today, it's weird to think of people sitting in a theater seeing that trailer and being like excited about the movie, but that was all trailers. Like, they were all like that. I don't know, just a weird thing.
Catherine Hardwicke is coming to town. There is an event at the Mount Baker Theater specifically to talk to Catherine Hardwicke. You can buy tickets for it, and they're playing Twilight at the Pickford as a part of this.
Why? What is she? She's not from here, right? Like, why is she?
I think she has a recent thing that's coming out or something. I don't know. The thing is, I am not going because I think Catherine Hardwicke is a bad director. And I feel bad about it because, like, I always want to support the women. But sometimes part of supporting the women is acknowledging that women can also be bad. And I think she's bad.
Yeah, no, it's really a shame when the ones who get the big chances are just not very good. But that is how it goes sometimes.
Like, it is not my favorite thing that I think the least competently directed of the Twilight movies is the only one that was directed by a woman. That is unfortunate. I wish that was not the case, but it's true. Anyway, so we watched Twilight. We'll watch New Moon next week, or this week. And then on Friday night, we went to go see Godzilla X Kong, The New Empire.
Which I also saw over the last week, yeah.
I had a really good time. I thought it was really fun.
Yeah, so I think, you know, we've been a fan of this franchise, both of us, from the beginning, I think. And I think even most of the people who really love them, I think, have the same, that every time you hear reviews from one of these, you get everyone, even the people who really like them, bring up the same thing, which is how does King Kong brush his teeth? Like, what's the dental care like for these giant monsters? And this movie finally gives us the answer to this question. There's a major plot point in this movie that revolves around King Kong having a bad tooth, which is very, just what a weird choice. It was very strange. Like, it sets it up at the very beginning and then it ends up being kind of pivotal to where the plot goes. Very strange.
It's very fun. It's deeply stupid and silly. I had a really good time. Dan Stevens, not as good of a time as Dan Stevens. No one had as good of a time as Dan Stevens.
I had a weird experience with Dan Stevens in this movie because I had seen him in the trailer and in my head I was like, oh yeah, I remember him from the previous Kong Godzilla movies. Because, like, so I've only seen them once each and they're just not that, like, I enjoy them, but they're not that memorable, right? But I had this memory when he showed up in the trailer of, like, yeah, he was a character in the last one who was like this nerdy scientist guy who had this theory about the Hollow Earth and he was like the only one who believed it and he had to convince people and then he turned out to be vindicated and all that. This was in my head. And then he showed up in this movie as like this rock and roll monster vet. And I leaned over to Jared. It's like, wasn't he like an Uber nerd in the previous movie? And Jared was like, no, he wasn't in the previous movie. And then I looked it up later. And not only is he not in the previous movie, I can't figure out who it was that I was thinking of. Do you remember that character that I'm talking about?
Are you mixing up one of the characters in Monarch with one of the characters?
No, because it was definitely, I mean, Monarch I watched pretty recently. I remember that one pretty well. It was definitely longer ago than that. Like,
I got nothing.
I don't know. He is clearly having a good time in this movie.
Great time.
Probably too good of a time, honestly. Like, they probably shouldn't have allowed that.
I'm here for them allowing it, honestly. It's very silly. I will say, so we watched, before we went to go see CNL, Before we went to go see Godzilla X Kong, we did finish Monarch. I didn't figure it would actually matter, but I wanted to finish. Actually, I think it made things more confusing because the whole thing in Monarch is that we find out that they're okay. So here's, tell me if I'm correct about this, because I've been thinking.
Are you wondering about the time dilation thing?
Yes, my understanding. Spoilers for Monarch, I guess. A big thing that we find out towards the end of Monarch is that there's time dilation. So are they? Is the place where the time dilation is happening not actually Hollow Earth? It's like an in-between space?
You know, I had the exact same issue, right? Because at the end of they keep making these references to the fact that throughout Monarch that Kurt Russell's character seems to be younger than he should based on his history that we know about him, and he just keeps making jokes about his good genetics or whatever. But then at the end, it turns out that, you know, and I kind of wonder if they just wrote that in because they were halfway through making it and they realized, like, oh shit, it doesn't actually make sense to have Kurt Russell playing this character who we know was this age during, like, you know, right after the war or whatever. And they needed to find a way to explain it because he clearly is not 95 years old. But I definitely was under the impression that they were in the Hollow Earth in that sequence. And I, if it was something else, it was not explained.
I was too, but it doesn't look like anything we've seen of Hollow Earth. It looks different than Hollow Earth, I feel like.
Well, it's clearly not the same part of it. But part of, I mean, even in this movie, they talk about how they've only mapped like 5% of it or something, right?
They do say that. Rebecca Hall, just really gung-ho going for it. She is delivering these lines.
I'm happy for Rebecca Hall that she gets to be in these movies and then do interesting stuff in her other projects. I feel bad for Brian Tyree Henry, who is stuck as the comic relief in a movie that doesn't have any jokes in it. just painful. He's a great actor. He's one of the real interesting great actors of recent years, in my opinion. And it's unpleasant to watch him in this.
I mean, I hope he's just getting a good check. I was pissed off he came back for this one because I found his character irresponsible in the last one of this conspiracy. I think I talked about it, but this conspiracy theorist who is who is proven right about this major conspiracy theory he has, but is also spouting anti-Semitic lizard people shit and fluoride and all of this different stuff. So
yeah, at least from what I recall, nothing in the movie that's framed as specifically anti-Semitic, but ties into conspiracy theories that actually exist that in real life have these.
Correct. Yes. I'm sorry. I wasn't saying that
the character is not meant to be anti-Semitic.
No, that's correct. It's just like spouting what I think are quite dangerous conspiracy theories that do have deeply anti-Semitic roots, and it felt really irresponsible for me to meet.
Yeah, it's the kind of conspiracy theories that you hear about the basic concept of them, and it just kind of sounds funny. But then if you actually dig into them, it's really kind of dark and disturbing. But the movie just takes them as the surface level. Ha ha! This guy believes in lizard people or whatever.
Also, it's supposed to be funny that he's showering in bleach all the time. It's dire, but whatever. There's less of that in his character in this one, so now he's just kind of nothing. I agree. I think it's unfortunate for him. But I had a really good time at the movie. I think that they have maintained basically what... Also, less than 2 hours. Not a lot of bloat in the series. In fact, if anything, they're getting tighter. Getting more ridiculous every time. I do love... I can't believe I didn't see more memes about this considering my social media stuff, but Godzilla says trans rights, right? He is the color of the trans flag when he comes up. And it was released on the weekend of Trans Day of Visibility.
Probably wasn't intentional, but you never know. It is... So a lot of the complaints that I've seen about this movie are around the fact that because in this one... The real thing that people have constantly said about these movies is that the human stuff is boring and the monster stuff is cool, right? That was the joke I was making earlier. But in this movie, it is 80% monster stuff. Kong is actually a character. He has his own motivations and thoughts, and obviously he doesn't speak, but he has his own sort of character arc. It's mostly about Kong. Godzilla really isn't it that much. So you spend a lot of time with Kong in Hollow Earth, where everything is huge. And so it is true that you lose some of the sense of scale, which was a big part of what made the earlier movies cool, that you have these, creatures that are they're bigger than any skyscraper and they're punching it out. And in this, there's a lot of Kong just in these forests and cliffs where everything is Kong sized. So it's almost just watching a Planet of the Apes movie or something. it doesn't have the same impact in that way. But I still thought it was cool watching King Kong punch Godzilla in the face and I still had fun with it. So,
yeah, I agree. You do lose some of that. It is interesting. And honestly, I think kind of a semi bold swing for them to make entire sections of this movie that are functionally a silent movie where you're just you're figuring, because they just roar at each other a lot. They don't even sign to each other or anything in the Planet of the Apes remake. So we don't have dialogue for a pretty significant portion of the movie. But I thought that was kind of cool. There's a lot of monsters and I have a lot of questions about this world in which, the way that you could not pay me enough money to go near a beach or a major city center when this is the world we live in. And yet there are just thousands of people on the Rio de Janeiro beach who are all dead now. The whole city of Rio de Janeiro is definitely
millions,
dead.
Millions of people died in this movie, which is that's a thing that a lot of people were complaining about with superhero movies for a while, that it just didn't seem to be taking into account the fact that clearly entire civilian populations are getting wiped out by these battles. It feels less of a problem in a movie this goofy, but it is true that...
It doesn't bother me in the same way here. And I think part of that is because it's really upsetting to have superheroes who can think and talk and reason and who are very big on saving people then destroy a bunch of people.
Godzilla doesn't give a shit about people. And he has no reason to. So.
Right. They don't know or care. King Kong is very connected to this one child and is fine with other people. He doesn't care it feels less I feel the worst part of it with superhero movies is you have these people spouting the importance of saving people, then they're murdering all of these people. So I feel that isn't involved there, but I do, it is still where I was wow, millions of people are definitely dead. Anyway, but I had a good time. I enjoyed it. I hope they keep making these fucking ridiculous films.
Which they will, because this one made boatloads of money. Like they do very well. So
I was gonna say, we didn't get to go see it opening weekend. We went the second weekend. The theater was still almost full, and I was thrilled to see it.
Yeah, Jared and I ended up having to sit in the front section of the theater, which almost never happens. Like, I haven't had to do that in ages. So yeah.
Yeah, it's a good time.
We are strictly back row people when possible. That's always correct. Been my. I know everyone kind of has their own their own approach to that, but I am a back row guy.
I am back row on the end because I don't like because that gives me more space. And if there is the back row end isn't available, then we go the next row down. But
Oh, interesting. I'm usually back row, like maybe 2/3 of the way over is my preference. But part of it is because specifically in the theater in our town, the back row has more legroom than any of the other rows. And I'm a very tall person, so that's very helpful for me. I don't have to like worry about my knees hitting the seat in front of me. But yeah,
for sure. Anyway, so watch that. And I'm not going to talk. The other thing we watched was Monkey Man. I'm not going to talk a ton about it because Joel's going to see it today, and I want to talk a lot more about it. Then it's incredible.
I'm very excited. Like I've been pumped for this movie since they put the trailer out a couple months ago. I'm really looking forward to it.
It's so beautiful, and by so beautiful, I don't just mean Dev Patel, but I do also mean Dev Patel, who looks incredible. What a beautiful man. It's so cool, and it's really... I had not walked into it, I think, understanding... It is really clear that Dev Patel loves John Wick and loves John Wick a lot. And I don't say that in any kind of like, it doesn't feel like a copy. It feels like an homage that he has made culturally specific in a way that is so cool. And I think you see it even in some of the color choices and like, you know, the like bright pink, like light
neon stuff.
Yeah. And it look, I am not intensely well versed in Indian politics, but as far as I can tell, he has made an incredibly contentious and bold political
film. That's why Netflix dumped it, from what I hear, because they have a huge audience in India. And that was why they decided not to release it. So yeah, it ended up. I think Jordan Peele's company ended up releasing it, right?
So I was so proud of him, weirdly. Like, it's incredible. Like, I mean, it's not, he stars in it, he wrote it, he directed it, he co-wrote it, he was the story originator. He killed himself to get this movie made.
Well, what I have read is that he is actually like an incredibly skilled, highly trained martial artist. Like, that is actually a thing that he has, and he's been trying for years to get a studio to cast him in a big martial arts action movie, and no one would do it. So he finally just made his own, which is awesome. Like, I mean, it sucks that he could, like, Dev Patel should have been, he should be a huge star by now. Like, he hit the scene with Slumdog Millionaire, which was a big success. It won Best Picture and all that. And like, people have known who he is since then, but he has just never had the chances that he should have as an actor. Obviously we were both big fans of The Green Knight a few years ago. And like, he's just a great actor. Really compelling presence, and yeah, also just amazing looking. And somehow I think we know why. It's not that hard to figure out, but he should have been a huge star by now, and hopefully this thing will really hit it for him.
Yeah, like, this is a movie, like, he has movie star power, and there are not that many people at this point who do, but he is, I mean, he's gorgeous, he's funny, he's such a good actor, and the martial arts shit and this stuff is, again, similar to John Wick, right, where like Keanu was able to do a lot of his own stunts because he does have martial arts training. And so we get, you know, it is not the like more clean shots that we see in like John Wick that are like it is more like chaotic, but it feels aligned with like sort of the whole vibe of the picture, but it is still a lot more like somewhat distant shots. We see a lot more of what's happening. I can't overstate enough that Dev Patel like killed himself to get this movie made. And in this movie, I am going to say it, and hopefully you won't be mad at me. I don't think it's a huge spoiler, but and in this movie, he determined that the spiritual guidance kick-ass people who are going to help him out, fucking trans people. Dev Patel also says trans rights.
Interesting. I hadn't heard that. That surprises me a bit.
Yeah. It's incredible. I can't wait. I can't wait till you see it. It's so cool. It's so cool. And the whole movie is just a fucking triumph. It's incredible. I will say, for people who might be concerned about this, for a movie that directly references John Wick early on, as well as sort of, like, there is a dog that is there for a short period of time. The dog does not die that we see. I was very stressed about that when it showed up. So
yeah, for anyone who doesn't know, there's a website that you can go to specifically doesthedogdie.com and look up any movie, and it's not just dogs, they'll tell you about any, and it's not just dying. I've used this for May before, because this is the thing that May gets very upset about, and if we're thinking about going to see a movie and I realize like, oh, maybe I in fact I did this with before we went to see Poor Things, because at least one of his movies has had like a real unpleasant animal cruelty thing, and it occurred to me as we were going into the theater, I was like, oh shit, I hope there is. So I pulled up the website and looked it up, and you can find all sorts of details about animal cruelty, and also things like, you know, if there's like sexual abuse portrayed on screen and all kinds of like sort of triggering things you can look for. It's a very useful website, I think. It's like the useful version of like the old like Screen It websites that we used to have to look at to make sure there weren't any boobs in movies before Dad would let us go see it.
Correct.
Anyway, I'm so excited to see it. I'm going to see it at, I think, 3:30 today, so like 4 hours from now. And I had never heard of this movie until they put out the trailer a couple months ago, and it's been like the thing I'm most excited about, except maybe the Furiosa movie this year.
We'll see. I think that it's an incredible triumph, and I hope it gets him the one of my favorite videos that I randomly ran across on Twitter or something like a few weeks, like a month or so ago, was right after it had played at like premiered at like Sundance or whatever, and like everyone giving him a standing ovation and him like crying on stage.
I saw that too. Yeah.
Anyway, we wish nothing but good things for Dev Patel.
Another brief, like I thought it was, I don't know if this has occurred to you, but it occurred to me the other day. It seems kind of funny that, so 2 weeks ago we had Godzilla Kong. This week we have Monkey Man. Next week we have Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. These are all coming out like 3 weeks apart. It's very strange.
Is that next weekend?
I'm pretty sure it's next week. Yeah. I'm pretty sure.
Shit. Okay.
It's within the next couple weeks. I'm pretty sure it's next week. Yeah, I have that title bothers me, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. But that franchise has always had weird title things, having Rise and Dawn and like, I mean, it always seemed out of order and weird. Anyway, I'm excited about that movie too. But
yeah, I can't wait for you to see Monkey Man, and maybe we'll, if we want to talk more about it, we can maybe do a spoiler section or something.
Yeah, that would probably be good. Yeah.
But everyone who has not go see it. It's wide release right now, and it like truly, it's incredible in a theater. It's visually just beautiful, and you should watch it.
Yeah, we're making a point of going to one of the RPX screenings where you get better sound and all of that, because it seems like a movie that's worth it. Yeah,
honestly, I kind of regret not doing that. We just went to a regular showing. But so yeah, that's all I got. What do you got? I don't. Oh, I guess one more thing. TV wise, we finally started season 3 of Reservation Dogs.
Oh, great.
So we're 3 episodes into that so far. A+, wonderful, wonderful as always. So,
okay. So the recently, Criterion put out a box set of Police Story and Police Story 2, the Jackie Chan movies, and I recently got my hands on a copy of that. Have you seen those movies?
Didn't I watch them with you?
Okay, you have the same misconception that I had, because in my head I was like, yeah, we watched the like pair of Jackie Chan cop movies from his early days in Hong Kong. Like, we watched them together. He has 2 such series, as it turns out, because I went to the Letterboxd page for it and I was like, what the hell? I haven't rated this. I know I saw it, and he did Project A. And Project A2, does that title sound familiar when you hear it?
Yes.
I didn't remember that, but those were the ones that we watched. So you may have seen Police Story, but you didn't watch it with me. I had not seen it before.
Maybe I didn't see it then. I'll look it up.
So anyway, this is a 1985, not like real early in his career. He was pretty well established by this point, I think. I think he had already done at least 1 or 2 Hollywood movies.
I have not seen Police Story.
There you go. But it's very much, you know, he directed it. It's very much his thing. It has a early Maggie Cheung performance. It may have even been her debut. I'm not sure. But he plays a cop who is in this anti-organized crime task force, and he gets he arrests like this mob boss's girlfriend early in the movie, and then she agrees to testify for them, and so he gets the job of guarding her, and the mob trying to kill her and all this. And it's very it's as a lot of Jackie Chan's, it's Charlie Chaplin with action, right? Like, there's just some honestly just gobsmacking stunt stuff going on in this movie, and not just like, you know, hand-to-hand combat stuff. And he always throws a lot of like like sort of slapstick comedy into his hand-to-hand combat, and there's a lot of that, but there's also like this really incredible sequence early on with this, like, the cops are trying to arrest the organized crime guys at like this slum town. It's like a squat town that is just, you know, it's just like makeshift buildings kind of built on this really steep hill, and they had blocked off the roads, so the organized crime guys are running, and they decide that they're just going to drive through the town to get to the bottom of the hill, and there's no streets in that. It's just like makeshift buildings. And so we get all these shots of all these cars just fucking booking it down this like extremely steep hill, running through buildings and explosions going off all around them because everyone has like gas cooking stoves there. So it's just like, and it goes on. It's like 3 minutes of this. I just couldn't believe it. I was just stunned. How many people, like, how many cars did they have to go through? They must have, I had the thought, like, they must have had to decide, they must have had to shoot this first, because and then at the end you have the shots of the cars driving away. Like, they must have had to decide which cars they drive away in based on which ones survived the trip down the hill. Like, because it's that impressive and dramatic, and it's just a blast, like, all the way through. It's very funny. Jackie Chan is extremely charming and just a fucking god of physical performance. I mean, just ridiculous stuff he's doing. And it's everything from like really, really impressive fight scenes to like pie in the face jokes. And like, it just really kind of runs the gamut, and it's all very funny. So I'm very much looking forward to watching the second one now, because I have them both and I realized that I hadn't seen either one of them and I loved the first one. So hopefully we'll do the second one soon, but I highly recommend.
Cool. I'll have to borrow them from you.
Then I did Godzilla. We didn't mention this. How do you say the name? Is it Godzilla X Kong? Is it just Godzilla Kong? Is it Godzilla times Kong? I have not heard it said out loud by anyone who seems to know how to say it.
I have just been saying Godzilla X Kong because I think that's funniest.
Okay, I've just been saying Godzilla Kong, but I don't know. Anyway, obviously we spent plenty of time talking about that one already. And then the other things that I have. So this last weekend, The First Omen came out, which is a prequel to The Omen, right? And I had heard they were making that and rolled my eyes and who cares.
I saw the trailer and had a similar response.
See, I saw the trailer and was kind of like, oh, some of the visuals actually look pretty impressive in this, but like, there's no way it's going to be actually good, right? Like, I feel like it's easy to cut a horror movie trailer that's pretty good. Like, there's something about it's easy to, relatively easy, I think, to get the, you know, make it a little creepy and throw in a jump scare and like, you know, dramatic shadows, whatever. But then I started hearing, when it came out, I started hearing from, like, seeing on Twitter and stuff, people saying that it was, like, really good. Like, that this was, like, the surprise horror movie of the year so far or whatever. So I was curious about it. Now, you're a big fan of The Omen, of the original.
I love the original Omen.
So this, I'm sure I'm not the first person to suggest this, but in my mind, there's kind of a similar... Because you know how there's like with 80s slasher franchises, there's like Halloween people and there's Nightmare on Elm Street people and there's Friday the 13th people, right? And you're very much a Nightmare on Elm Street person and I'm very much a Halloween person. And I feel like there is a similar dichotomy with 70s horror. There's Exorcist people and there's Omen people.
I think that's true.
I don't know. And, you know, this is all kind of friendly rivalry. It's not, most people who are into movies like them all. And I also like Nightmare on Elm Street, but I just prefer Halloween. I spent a little time trying to think of what the Friday the 13th would be in this dichotomy. The only thing that I could come up with was Suspiria, which it was also a franchise and has sort of continued to this day because there was a remake a few years ago. I don't think that's totally fair because Suspiria is a great movie and Friday the 13th is not. So it's not really the odd man out in the same way. But anyway, this is all. I've been thinking about this a lot lately. I have only seen the original Omen once. I liked it, but I didn't like it as much as you did. But I figured I'd rewatch it before, and I happened to have... I was going to go see The First Omen on Friday evening. I happened to have Friday afternoon with nothing to do, and it was another. We're doing a lot of side notes here because we're not running very long. I'm doing a lot of side notes here. Have you noticed that the thing with there's a sequel or a remake of a thing coming out, and therefore the original is not available to stream for free anywhere? That seems to have come to an end. Like, The Omen was easy to find. Last time I talked about Roadhouse, the original, like, Amazon just put out a remake of Roadhouse. Amazon is showing the original Roadhouse. It seems like they've finally figured out, like, this is fucking stupid. People are going to stream it at any rate. So the original Omen is streaming on Hulu, which is, you know, it's owned by Fox Disney, which is also putting out the first Omen. So, so I watched the original again.
You did not like it enough.
I like it. It's a cool movie. There's some really cool stuff in it. I don't know. It just doesn't work for me the same way that it does for you. And I wish it did. I really love Gregory Peck. I think he's great. Part of it is the kid who is just like a nothing. The kid playing Damien. Like, I feel like there's a hole in the middle of the movie where there should be something really compelling, and it's the kid is. It almost like they had to shoot around him because he's so uninteresting. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I think that for me, I feel similarly about Exorcist. I understand there's a lot of like technical skill behind it. It just doesn't do anything for me. Most of the time it does. Like, I, at this point in my life, am very rarely like frightened by a film. That's not really a thing that happens to me very often. I would say the last time I remember that happening is during a few scenes of the first Conjuring movie when I went to go see that by myself in theaters. I had a few genuinely like creeped out moments. For the most part, that doesn't really happen to me.
Hereditary didn't do it for you? That was definitely the one for me.
Okay, so here's the thing with Hereditary. Hereditary fucked with me a lot in like a mom issues kind of way, but there were two teenagers in my theater who wouldn't shut the fuck up. So like it was hard to, you know. So I don't know what it would have been if I had watched it in a more ideal setting. But regardless, I think that what happens a lot of the time, this does not mean that I enjoy watching a lot of horror movies. As we've discussed, Joel has gotten much farther down the horror path than me in the last few years, and I've sort of retreated off a lot of it. I find it stressful and unpleasant more than like frightening. I just don't like, and I don't, you know, I am not like in any way like specifically opposed to gore or whatever in movies, but it really has to grab me in some way for it to feel that way. The Exorcist, it just, I get bored. Like, that's why, like, if it just feels like gross and shock value-y to me, which is not what I'm saying that The Exorcist is actually doing necessarily, although I think it's a part of what it's doing, but like, it bores.
Shock value is absolutely a part of what The Exorcist is doing. I don't think anyone would deny that.
It just like, it, I just don't want to sound like I'm like discounting this classic film. But like, I get bored. I get like, I just, it doesn't, because it doesn't grab me in the way it's clearly intended to grab me. And I just don't, I've watched The Exorcist two or three times now, and it just doesn't do it. Although I loved the TV show that it eventually spawned. But The Omen, I think, which doesn't have any of that, like it isn't like a gross out thing in the same way. I feel there are some in the nanny falling on the, like there's some deaths, but like it doesn't feel.
It's definitely milder in its horror than The Exorcist for sure. Yeah.
And I think that I enjoy. Okay, tell me if I'm wrong, because I'm realizing it's been a lot of years since I saw The Omen, and I was just talking to Morgan about this the other day, and I was like, I think I'm correct here. There is, like, a period of time where you could reasonably conclude that Gregory Peck is actually losing his mind, right? Like, that, like I'm not saying, like, I just feel like where it makes sense that he isn't sure if this is real. Like, it's not, like, I don't know. No? You think no? Okay.
I don't know. I mean, in my mind, it's, I don't know. I guess it's hard to separate because obviously I knew going, even the first time I saw it, I knew going in. But in my mind, it's pretty clear that there's something sinister going on from the beginning when the hospital gives him the baby. But I don't know. Maybe that may be because I knew that.
Yeah, I don't know. Anyway,
he's actually resistant to the idea that anything is going on for most of the movie. Like, even when he goes to, like, the expert who explains what's going on and the whole process that needs to be carried out to kill Damien, he's like, I'm not doing it, because it's probably nothing. But I don't know.
Either way, I think that, I do love Gregory Peck, of course, but I think that it's just more of a, like, I will watch movies that have a fair amount of gore in them, and sometimes I will enjoy them, but there has to be a lot for me other than that. And I feel like The Omen is mostly the lot that I like other than that, and I don't have to, the gore stuff just isn't there, which is better for me. So I think it just lands for me differently. But yeah, it's one of those definite dichotomies that you and I like.
Well, at any rate, the Omen is another one of those movies for me that I expect to go back to it again someday, and I do kind of expect that eventually it will hit better for me. But at this point, I'm kind of like, I enjoy it. It's a fun movie. you know, I wasn't sorry I watched it or anything, but it's just not, it's not like all-time favorite horror movie for me the way, you know, a lot of other things are. At any rate, so I went to see The First Omen, which, again, confusing title. Because we, not only do we have The Omen, but we have the remake that is also just called The Omen. So normally if you say The First Omen, you're referring to the original, but now we have a movie that is called The First Omen. It's the same, like, it's not quite like the Halloween and Scream thing where they just reused the name, but it's almost worse. But anyway, The First Omen is the story of how that child came to be at the hospital and was given to Gregory Peck, right? That's, it is very unfortunate, I think, that it came out 2 weeks after Immaculate came out, because there's a lot of surface similarities, and I'm sure it was just a coincidence that they just happened to come out so close together. But both movies start with this young American woman going to, in Immaculate, it's a convent, and this is like an orphanage in Rome, to become a nun, and then, you know, discovers dark, sinister things being done by the authorities in the, like, there's a lot of sort of obvious similarities, and to the point where I literally heard there were two, I don't know if they were teenagers or, there were two young ladies sitting behind me at the theater, and at one point I heard one of them whisper to the other, "This is the same plot as Immaculate," which it is not, but it is unfortunately similar. I talked about Immaculate last week. You may recall I said that it was one of those movies where I felt like, in hindsight, I had probably come out of it feeling better about it than it deserved because it had such a strong ending. This movie's the opposite. It's about, almost all of it is really, really good. And then it has the last like 5 minutes is this completely like boneheaded epilogue that is like franchise service terrible. But almost everything else, at least for me, was really cool and worked really well. It also does not have the advantage of Sydney Sweeney in the lead role. The lead actress is someone named Nell Tiger Free, which is an unlikely name. I had never heard of her before. Apparently, she was in seasons 5 and 6 of Game of Thrones as Myrcella Baratheon. I don't know if you remember that character. I haven't watched Game of Thrones.
There were a lot of Baratheons.
Yeah. And it was directed by first-time feature director. Her name is Arkasha Stevenson. She worked on a show, a miniseries that you may remember me talking about a few years ago on here called Brand New Cherry Flavor, that was like a weird horror thing that I really liked. She was one that she directed some of that.
I don't think I realized it was directed by a woman. That is.
It is, yeah. and it also has Ralph Ineson, who is the guy who played the father in The Witch. He has like one of the all-time great voices. He plays his character is the priest he's in The Omen. He's the priest who comes to Gregory Peck to try to warn him about what's going on, right? It's the same character. He's basically the only familiar face in it, for me at least. A lot of, and Bill Nighy. Bill Nighy is in it in kind of a smaller role. I forgot about that. But it is less, it's a very like sort of slow burn horror. It's not like, you know, throwing scary shit at you nonstop or anything like that. Not like a lot of jump scares or anything. It's more of a mood dread thing. There's a lot of really cool visuals in it. I really liked it. I was really into it. I don't know that I want them to make a sequel to it, but I think they're probably going to, in a way that seems like it would have to be in like absurd contradiction to what we see as the series has progressed, you know, I keep wanting to say in The First Omen, I'm talking about this thing with the title, The Original Omen. It seems like they can't make a sequel to this one without directly contradicting that one. But it also seems like they're setting it up to do more of them. So I don't know what's going to happen there. I kind of wish they wouldn't. And maybe they won't end up doing it because I don't think this one did that well from what I heard. I think it has kind of been overshadowed by Immaculate, which is unfortunate because this is a better movie. So yeah, that's my, I liked it better than the original. I don't know that that would be the case for you. I guess it probably wouldn't be since you love the original so much. But it's a really cool movie. I think it's definitely worth checking out.
I think we watched like the second Omen at some point, right? Like the one with, did we watch the one with Sam Neill? I can't remember.
Okay, so I was trying to remember. We watched either the second Omen or the second Exorcist movie, and I can't remember. Sam Neill was in the third one, which I have not seen.
I don't think I would have eagerly gone to watch the second Exorcist.
It looks like I did watch, it's called Damien Omen 2. I gave it 2 stars. I don't remember anything about it.
I gave it 3 stars. I liked it more. Anyway, it might be kind of fun this year for Halloween, maybe for Morgan and I to watch all of the Omen movies. That might be kind of an interesting. Yeah, I mean, like, you know, I'm willing to watch it, and it, having a female director is always a plus for me. But not in theaters probably, but I'll watch it at home. There's a bunch of horror franchises that Morgan and I have not watched, largely because I don't watch horror that much these days. But like, we've watched the first 2 Scream movies. We haven't, but Morgan hasn't seen any of the others. I really wanted to have them watch the Netflix ones from the books.
The Fear Street ones.
Yeah, because I haven't seen those, and those are great.
Another one of those. I don't know if you saw that.
I've heard. I don't know if it's coming out this year or not. Anyway, but whatever. I'll only be working 10 hours a week by then, so maybe we'll have time.
I mean, the Scream franchise is easy. It's not like those are intense, scary movies. Those are just fun watches.
No, I know. I think what happens a lot of times for me is that, like, Halloween is, like, coming when the dark times are descending, and I am often very sad, and I don't want to watch dark things as much, which is not ideal. I don't know. We'll see how I feel this year. But I would be down to watch... I would love to rewatch The Omen, and Morgan's never seen it. And I would even rewatch the shitty remake from 2006 that I saw. I had a fun theater experience with
that. I never saw that one. Was it Liev Schreiber? Am I remembering that right? Was that who played the peck role?
That's one of my fondly remembered theater experiences. There were like 15 of us in the theater, and like we all laughed at all the same parts. They were not intended to be funny. It was a good time. So yeah, I don't know. That might be a fun project, but I'm glad you liked it.
Yeah, I was really impressed with it. So yeah, I definitely recommend it for anyone who's interested in that kind of thing.
Cool.
And it was better than Immaculate, which is the one that's getting all the attention and making all the money. So
I may also watch Immaculate when it comes out, just because I'm kind of curious about Sydney Sweeney's like devotion to this piece. But not in theater. I just, for the most part, I really only go see horror movies in theaters at this point if they're like one of like 2 directors. You know, if Ari Aster is putting out a new horror movie or whatever, I'll go see it. But for the most part, I wait till home now. Anyway.
So that's the last movie I have. I have one TV thing real quick that I actually just started this morning. Netflix has put out a series of The Talented Mr. Ripley, which is called Ripley, with what's his name?
Andrew Scott.
Yeah, not Adam Scott. That's a different guy. Andrew Scott as Ripley. And I am a big fan of The Talented Mr. Ripley, and I also read the book and I really liked it. And this is all like, it's all in black and white. It's all like very striking. It looks really cool. I watched the first episode this morning. It has Dakota Fanning. I don't want to say Dakota Johnson. It's not Dakota Johnson. It has Dakota Fanning, who I feel like I haven't seen in a long time, and I don't even know that I would have recognized her because she actually looks like an adult now. And also that guy, what's his name? He was in that that Emma adaptation. Was it Emma adaptation a couple years ago?
Like as the main guy? Because
yeah.
I did not like
him. Yeah, I remember you didn't like him in that. And I don't know that he was great in that, but I've seen him in other things too, and I generally like him. He plays the Jude Law character, the Dickie Greenleaf character.
He is not as pretty as Jude Law.
No, he's not. And at this point, he's only really had, like, the first episode was mostly set up. He's only really had, like, 1 or 2 scenes. So I don't have a sense yet of how good he is for the role. But it is very, very striking looking. It's like has really good kind of atmosphere to it, and I am definitely interested in Andrew Scott stuff now. So I'm looking forward to getting more into that. I think it's 8 episodes, so I assume I'll be talking about that more going forward.
Yeah, I know Morgan really wants to watch it, but I think has not seen The Talented Mr. Ripley, so I thought we would watch that first.
Yeah, that's the only one I've seen. There's like, I don't know if you know this, there's like 5 or 6 different movie adaptations of various Ripley books. that none of them are as well known as The Talented Mr. Ripley. There was a French one from the 60s that was also an adaptation of The Talented Mr. Ripley. There was one with John Malkovich that was an adaptation of one of the sequels from like that came out in like 2012, I think. And there's at least a couple others, but I haven't seen any of the others.
This is brand new information.
I know, like, yeah, they really, they have not, Yeah, they haven't gotten the kind of... There hasn't been like a franchise of it, so to speak. It hasn't, but there have been other adaptations, yeah.
Huh, okay, well, anyway, so yeah, I think we'll probably get to that. We're just trying to, I don't know, we've watched, there's one more episode left of The Regime. It's been pretty good. It's Kate Winslet, it's been doing a great job, as she often does. Some cool costuming. Max is releasing a new Cults series week to week, so I've been watching that. The Cyanon, it apparently started out as like a drug and alcohol recovery thing and then took a left turn. So the first episode of that came out last Monday, so we watched that. And yeah, so those are kind of things I've been watching. But I think that's all I got.
Okay. Yeah. How long did we end up going here? We were thinking it was going to be a short episode, but I don't think it was.
I think our actual talking, when the audience will not have to hear when I had to leave the room to put Dee Dee in his crate. I think our actual talking was probably under 90 minutes, I would guess. Maybe around.
Okay. So around our average, I guess.
Yeah, not too bad. I feel like when we know we have more time, we expand more on the stuff we've been watching. Oh,
sure.
So
I definitely did this time, yeah.
But that's fun. I enjoy this conversation. Okay, well, we will be back next time with In Good Company. Hooray.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.